Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Welcome to another edition of Life Behind Bars. I'm Noah Rothbaum, the Daily Beast half-full editor. Joining me, as always, is my colleague and co-host, David Wondrich. How's it going?
All right. How are you today?
I'm pretty good. Excited to talk about one of my favorite subjects.
And mine.
Whiskey, our old friend.
Yeah, whiskey.
Ishkabaha.
Yeah. Oh, man.
The Gaelic for water of life, which has become, I guess, bastardized in the several hundred years since people actually said Ishkabaha and turned into the word
Ishkabibble. Whiskey,
ultimately. Yeah. Somehow it went from Ishkabaha to whiskey. Don't ask me how.
I think there was whiskey involved.
How many games of telephone before the telephone was ended where people finally started calling it whiskey? But that's the derivation of the name. And I think it's sort of fitting that it has international roots.
Well, you know what I love is you walk down the street in Dublin and there are all these little iron hatches on the in the pavement that say whiskey on them, U-I-S-C-E, like, because it's whisky beata in Irish Gaelic. And it's like, wait, you open this up and that's where you get the whiskey from? But it just means water, it turns out.
Right, right. You're like, I looked. I double-checked.
Yeah, I double-checked. I opened every one of them. Totally I feel like I was kind of taken for a ride there.
A little bit. Yeah, I mean, a Gaelic joke on all of us.
Yeah. There's no whiskey in there.
Whiskey writers.
Yeah. There's just no whiskey in there.
I mean, it wasn't that long ago when I thought, you know, a bar had a international whiskey selection. If they had an Irish whiskey, a Scotch, and some bourbon. You know what I mean?
Maybe, you know, a bottle of Canadian Club down on the lower shelf.
Sure. Yeah. You know, that was it. I mean,
That was pretty cosmopolitan.
And those four bottles you'd see over and over again, and they were often pretty much the same brands. Yep. I mean, you didn't even get much variation in those.
If the bar had rye, that meant it was a gourmet bar.
Or the bottle had been there for like 30 years.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
Nobody.
That's true. Yeah. And those fruit flies pickled in the bottom.
Right, exactly.
Those are vintage.
Right, exactly.
That was 28 generations was like of fruit flies.
Layers of dust on the bottle.
Yeah.
But that, I mean, that was it. I mean, now, you know, drinkers are really spoiled. I mean, you have such a vast selection of whiskeys.
Oh, my God.
You know, and you know, all over every corner of the U.S. is now making bourbon and rye and single malt and
It's not just bourbon and rye. Yeah. Whiskey.
Wheat, sorghum whiskey, all types of, you know, straight corn whiskey, unaged whiskey. If anything, it's the craft spirits phenomenon, this trend of all these distillers. I think there are now nearly 2,000 of them across the country.
It's unbelievable.
Several in every state.
And what's interesting to me is if you went like back before Prohibition, the way the whiskey business worked in America is there were some big distillers. You know, Mount Vernon made rye. There were some big bourbon distillers.
Yeah. Stitzel Weller.
Exactly.
Winkle's original one.
Yeah, there was a Guckenheimer in Pennsylvania. Oh, yeah. Overholt.
I was just about to say, one.
Yeah, and so there were these big national brands. But there were also local distilleries everywhere.
Yeah.
And they made a lot of interesting stuff.
Yeah.
They made a lot of stuff that was maybe not that great, but it was local and it was cheap.
Sure.
And it was available. And and they somehow managed to coexist where you have all the big guys plus all the small guys too.
And some of the big guys were buying the small guys and combining them. And I think when people now, especially the whiskey nerds, are so militant about some of the categories. And if anything, you know, all bets were off, you know, 100 years ago or even 50 years ago, where some of the categories, the definitions were much looser. And, you know, a lot of the things that we take as fact, you know, back in the day, you know, people did things.
I mean, what it really is it's a post-prohibition convenience, you know, because to get whiskey back after repeal, they had to make a lot of compromises.
Oh, yeah.
And one of them was the government did not want to go out and have to hire people to regulate 2,000 distilleries.
Right, of course.
It was in their interest to have it be like 20 distilleries or 50 distilleries. Yeah. And that's what you had.
You know, it became streamlined, like a lot of things, and industrialized and big business.
Which is what the 20th century did.
Yeah, I mean, really the modern whiskey business begins in the late 1800s. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, by the time that Prohibition ends, what emerges is a way different and way more sophisticated industry run by a few giant conglomerates, you know, absolutely. Shenley, Seagram's.
Yeah. National
exactly. And,
distillers.
And they own dozens of distilleries, and they're, you know, it's a way more sophisticated yeast programs and grain, and it's,
I've got a Seagram's Distillers Handbook from 1940, which is just super technical and up to date.
And it's
their manual for all their distillers.
Wherever they are.
Yeah.
You know, Canada.
Canada, it doesn't matter.
Indiana, Kentucky, doesn't matter. And it becomes.
They built one kind of distillery.
Exactly. So that, you know, a lot of these permutations and different things sort of get drummed out of the system. And now, if anything, this craft spirits movement, one of its greatest gifts, I would say, is opening up people's eyes to all different types of whiskey.
And it's breaking that up again. You know, it's saying, okay, we don't just want bourbon and maybe a little bit of rye.
Yeah.
We want like a lot of different kinds of rye. We want a lot of different kinds of bourbon. We want more corn whiskey because that's interesting.
Yeah.
We want wheat whiskey. We want barley whiskey. We want millet whiskey.
Cobalt.
Yeah.
In Chicago, it's all types of
quinoa. Millet. Exactly. We're crazy grains.
And some of those are quite delicious. Some of them, but some of them are actually really cool.
Absolutely. Also, some of these small distilleries have been open long enough to have fully aged stock on hand now, where when you taste it, it's like, okay. You know, this is not, I'm not just being indulgent and patting them on the head and saying, try.
Yeah.
I'm actually drinking good whiskey now.
Oh, yeah.
And that's revolutionary.
And I think it's cool because it's even some of these upstarts have changed the way that whiskey is being made in Kentucky. I hate the Silicon Valley term of disruption. But in this case, they've disrupted in the oldest way possible by making a product that's competitive but different that has now made the big guys actually kind of rethink. The way that
they're starting to pay attention to what, you know, and they're saying, we don't have to just make like the one kind of whiskey.
Exactly.
There's a lot of different interesting things. And I mean, this isn't just an American trend either. Scotland, some of their moves are a little weird with the perennial problem for them of how do you sell blended whiskey when everybody thinks single malt is sexier.
Right.
But nonetheless, they're making moves there too.
And the number of distilleries in Scotland has
grown.
Substantially. I mean, I think there's over 90 for about a decade, and now it's well over 100 with all the different grain distilleries and single malt distilleries. Yeah. You know, they're bringing back, you know, some of the ghost distilleries, Bora and Port Ellen.
They're putting distilleries on islands that never had legal distilleries before.
Exactly.
I mean,
Wales now has distilleries.
Yeah.
You know, England is
making. England used to make a lot of grain spirit in the 18th and 19th centuries.
Sure.
And, you know, until they outsourced it all to Scotland.
Absolutely.
But now it's coming back.
Which is kind of in Ireland. I mean, you know, years.
Well, let's talk about what's going on in Ireland. It's crazy. When I first went to Ireland in 2001, there were three distilleries on the island.
And one of them was pretty brand new. I mean,
There was the Cooley Distillery was 12, 13 years old.
And we had really just started getting their whiskeys in like 99.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember.
It took them a while to get up and running and to get things aged and all that. But so there was that. And there was the Bushmills Malt Distillery and the huge Middleton Distillery that made all the blended whiskeys. And
Bushmills all the way up north.
Yep, and all the way down south in Cork.
Exactly.
And Bushmills and the Middleton Distillery were owned by the same company.
For a long time, yeah.
Yeah, at the time.
But those three distilleries, Bushmills, Cooley, and Middleton, or Jameson, literally every Irish whiskey for years was either a bottled one of those whiskeys, you know, one of those distilleries whiskeys bottled straight or a blend of whiskeys from those three distilleries. Yeah. And that was every brand.
That was it. That was
There's no other.
Yeah. And now there are some of the brands who used to contract with them, like Tullamore Dew, have gone back to having their own distilleries again.
And I think that they'll start making all of their own, I think, next year or the year after. So it's pretty.
They're getting there. The distillery's up and running. They're putting stuff in barrels. The
Teeling brothers have built a distillery in Dublin. Yeah. I mean, like, basically, there are all of these. There's a whole, you know, huge boom of Irish gins.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, you know.
That's the precursor to whiskey.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do we make while the whiskey's aging?
Gin. Gin and vodka, and in that case, gin. So, you know, we've seen all of these gins, and Ireland has kind of gone crazy for gin, which means all these gin distilleries in probably the next 3-4 years will also be bottling all their whiskeys. So we're going to see all types of – and if the gins are any indication, because they are
– all over the place.
And really wildly creative. Mm-hmm. Some of them are tasty. Some of them are interesting.
Yeah.
To put it politely.
Some of them are not even interesting.
Right. Sure. Well, it will be really interesting because the whiskeys will also be all over the map.
I mean, but that's also, as here, it's forced the bigger companies to take some risks also. I mean, Middleton, the Irish distillers, Pernod Ricard, you know, huge international company, they've been releasing all kinds of interesting expressions of pure pot still whiskeys.
Fans of pure pot still whiskey.
There used to be only one. That was Redbreast.
Huge, wonderful news, really. I mean, it's, you know, one of these things. You know, Yellow Spot, Green Spot, Red Spot, you know, all of the different.
Powers John's Lane, Powers Signature. It goes on and
Red Breasts. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of amazing just that the number of, you know, pure pot still expressions, and, you know, Bushmills of the North has been releasing more single malts at different ages.
From Middleton, from Irish distillers, they've launched a whiskey aged in Irish oak barrels. They're trying that out. Huh. They've got one whiskey aging in Irish oak barrels. But going back to the early 19th century, even to the 18th century, they never used Irish oak. There was no Irish oak. They cut down all the trees. Right. It was always North American oak. They'd get the oak from shipped out of Quebec or out of New Orleans. Yeah. And that was the Irish whiskey industry for, you know,
for all of the
for 100 and for almost 200 years has been using American oak. But now, just to be like extra correct, they're using Irish oak. And it's like, okay,
sure,
that was never
why not?
A thing,
okay,
whatever. Yeah. Another cool thing is Kilbeggan just launched a whiskey made with rye in the mash bill.
Yeah.
And they can't call it a pot still whiskey, although it was made in pot stills, because it has too much rye. You're allowed 3% by the Irish law of other grains besides malted barley and unmalted barley. And
ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
That's recent. They used to have, up until the 1950s, they used to use rye and oats in their whiskey, like up to, you know, maybe 15-20% of each sometimes.
Amazing.
And this one is 30% rye.
Which, again, I mean, I think it's interesting because Beam Suntory, you know, which bought Cooley, which makes Kilbeggan, I mean, clearly the rebirth of American straight rye whiskey is now driving that Irish straight rye whiskey or rye pot still whiskey.
I mean, also they're kind of paying attention to what's going on. I helped years ago with my friend Tad Seasted, who runs a small distillery in Oregon, and he wanted to try out something interesting in whiskey, and I suggested he try the old Irish mash bill with rye and oats, and he did, and he made a very successful whiskey called the Emerald. You know, in very tiny amounts. It's no competition for anyone. But I think that got a lot of attention, and it sort of pushed the Irish a little bit to say, you know, this is our tradition. Why don't we try this?
And it's not just Ireland. It's, you know, we're seeing whiskeys and new whiskeys from, you know, up in Scandinavia, Myra in Sweden, they're huge drinkers, you know, of single malt and whiskey in general. Japan, which, you know, the, you know, Suntory goes back to the 1920s and really, you know, in their main competitor, Nika, I mean, for years, you know, most of the whiskey was drunk inside of Japan. I mean, it was if you wanted it, you went to Japan.
Yeah. Who was going to export that stuff?
And it was, you know, and the demand there, I mean, it's only because of like their prolonged recession, you know, that took, you know, 30 years to finally clear up that they, you know, they're like, okay, maybe we'll start selling it. We have a little bit of excess. Let's start selling it in America. You know, just a few years, Japanese whiskey has gone crazy. I mean, it went from, you know, I remember Suntory, you know, pouring at Whiskey Fest and nobody would go up, you know, for the Yamazaki.
Well, you know, it's funny because the rap was that it was imitation scotch. Right. What they didn't realize, it was imitation really good scotch.
Right. And that was, you know, from 1920. Like, yeah. It wasn't.
Yeah. They've been making it forever.
Right. And it's, you know, they had way more interesting stuff that they were selling in Japan than they ever sold here. And finally, when some of that stuff, the Hibikis, the Hakushus, finally made it here, you know, really in the last 6, 7, 8 years.
Yeah, I mean, I remember helping them launch the Yamazaki in 2008, maybe.
Yeah.
And it was a hard sell. People were like, what is this stuff?
Even when when the Hibiki finally came here. Yeah, it was about maybe a little bit less. I remember 09, maybe 10, it came and it just blew my mind. Yeah. And that has led to this giant, you know, demand.
But I mean, now we're seeing even other stuff from Japan, like there's the Kikori whiskey, which is a shochu, a rice spirit, usually distilled to very low proof. And here they distilled it to quite a normal proof and aged it a little bit longer. And suddenly you've got something that's in the whiskey world, but very different.
Right, exactly.
You know, and quite pleasant.
And then all these other, you know, kind of upstart Japanese whiskey distilleries. I mean, a lot of it's sort of modeled, again, on the American craft movement. I mean, there weren't craft distilleries in other places. And then we, you know.
You've got Taiwan, absolutely. Award-winning whiskey there.
Yeah, for sure. And then, you know, from India, you've Amrut, which is, you know, has been around for decades, but is really in the last decade finally come to America. Mm-hmm. Sort of, I mean, it's still limited, but widely-ish available, and it's really delicious. And
they've been making whiskey since the 1940s. Yeah, so, you know,
I mean, fascinating stuff.
They learned what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an amazing time to be a whiskey drinker.
It's even cracked open the last frontier of good whiskey, which is Canada. The Canadians were so stubborn. You know, I've been to most of the distilleries in Canada, the old ones, right? And everyone, they'd always show me like, here's some of the spirit we make. And among those spirits, there'd be just this delicious stuff, you know, soft, rich, creamy, wonderful. And then you taste a finished product and you go, where's all that stuff that I tasted? Why? You know, it's not in here. I mean, this whiskey is fine, but it's a little thin and kind of really light. And that stuff was so good. What happened to that?
Right.
And now they're bottling that. Finally, they're taking some of the Kobe beef out of the hamburger and keeping it unground, you know, and it's really good.
People started going up there and quietly on the sly buying all that stuff and bottling it, you know, and maybe at the beginning not being 100% transparent that it was Canadian whiskey.
That was unfortunate.
But it ultimately, I think, helped because it showed that the stuff is really good and without people's preconceived notions of what Canadian whiskey is or was, you know, these things started winning awards and people were praising them. And then only later did they find out that they were Canadian. It was like the old, like, you know.
Yeah, the old switcheroo.
Exactly. The coffee commercial. Like, this is actually, you know, Maxwell House in your cup. You know,
not, you know. It's not the fine Colombian
coffee. Exactly you thought, you know, and it's, you know, it's kind of a funny thing. That led to new distilleries in Canada. I mean, for years there were no craft distilleries. Now there are craft distilleries. The bigger companies are now releasing all types of stuff, cracking open their vaults. I mean, the nice thing about Canadian whiskey, unlike American whiskey, is that instead of blending all the grains together in the mash. Basically, they made all the whiskeys separately and then would blend them once they were aged.
I mean, one of the best whiskeys I've had in recent years was a 12-year-old Canadian pure corn whiskey, 100% corn, aged up there in a cold northern climate in well-used barrels, so there's not really a lot of oak on it.
Yeah.
And it was just this – it was like cream, you know?
Yeah, I can
it was
only
just
imagine.
Like just this soft, creamy, absolutely delicious thing, the kind of thing that's just Moorish, as in, I want more. You know, keep pouring me that. Can I have a little more of that?
Exactly.
It's really good. Can I have some more, please?
Yeah.
And it's one of those things you put a bottle out and it's empty before your friends stand up.
And it's one of these things where even if countries or regions aren't making whiskey, we're seeing even some of the distillers get wood. You know, they're experimenting with oak from, you know, all types of crazy places.
Yeah, like they're doing in Ireland.
Pulling wood from all over. I mean, people like Buffalo Trace are experimenting with wood from all over. I mean, some of the experiments are delicious. Some of them I want to try, but are really god awful.
Yeah.
And the wood is extremely expensive and maybe not.
Yeah, it's difficult.
For
I know. But
it's interesting. I mean, some of those things are getting released with all types of.
I'm curious. Well, I know somebody was using hickory. A small distillery up in Canada was doing hickory casks. The problem with hickory casks is they leak like sons of bitches.
Yeah.
Because hickory is just not a tight wood grain. And so, you know, they'd put in like 50 gallons, they'd end up with 5.
Right. Is that what?
Oh, well.
Try one. That's the beauty of being small, I guess.
But, you know, I want to see more stuff like that. You know, why not use maple, for instance? Why not use other hardwoods?
Yeah, we've seen a little bit of maple, which also is leaky, but the whiskey that I've tasted is delicious. Like Woodford did one that was maple, and that was really good. And, I mean, I think if anything, we've only kind of scratched the surface, you know, in terms of innovation and, you know, the frontier with all.
Yeah, the laws have to catch up right now because the laws in America are very restrictive as to what you can call whiskey.
And in Scotland, too.
Yeah, in Scotland, too, which is great for consumers if you've got a bunch of cynical large corporations trying to cut their bottom line at every opportunity.
Right.
That means they can only cut so far.
Right.
But it also limits people from doing really interesting things, you know, because you can't call it whiskey or you can't call it this or that.
I mean, I think people are, you know, the fear was always that if you can put the word bourbon or straight rye or scotch, that nobody will buy. And I think if anything.
I don't think the modern generation gives a shit about anything
I don't think so. And some of these brands like Compass Box in Scotland have done some really funky, cool stuff that's yielded delicious whiskey. And whether or not they can call that scotch, I don't think has really affected, you know, their sales, which is encouraging to say the least.
Yeah.
I think will only mean that the laws ultimately probably will change to include some of these new variants and new techniques. And
I mean,
you know,
I certainly hope so. And
I'm
all, you know, the more whiskey from the more places, the better for me. I just think it's a beautiful thing. I mean, I was up in the foothills of the Alps in January at the Braulio distillery where they make Braulio, one of the beloved Italian Amari, right?
Yeah.
And the guy who makes Braulio was showing us around in his distillery, which is very weird because it's several stories down the side of a mountain.
Wow.
You know, just all built into the mountain.
It's like Bond film.
Yeah, it was like a James Bond lair full of Amaro.
Right.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And all in these big, huge wooden casks. It all gets rested in wooden casks. And finally, he takes us to his little paradis where he keeps rare stuff. And in there, there's a standard size, like, oak barrel, right? A French oak barrel. And we go, what's in that? He goes, well, there's only a little bit left, but that was the whiskey I made 12 years ago.
Wow.
And he let us taste it. And it was absolutely delicious.
Right.
And it's like, why didn't you make more? He goes, it was just an experiment. And I don't really, you know, I'm not a whiskey drinker. He wasn't going to make any more. He made it once. That was
all
enough.
Right, fair enough.
And you know, and he let it sit for 12 years finally. And and it just got really delicious. And this just really soft malt whiskey, you know, with a
– It would not surprise me if we see Italian whiskey, more French whiskey.
Yeah. I mean, there's tons of Italian craft beers right now.
I mean,
craft
it's the
beer is sort of the precursor to craft whiskey.
Exactly. And the way in production, too.
Yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me if we see a lot more whiskey coming out of, you know, Europe, you know, from countries that don't traditionally make it start to make it.
Well, I mean, Italy has a great climate for aging whiskey because you've got mountains. So you can age it in the warmth, and then you can move it up the mountain, you know, and then let it age in the cool. So you've got – you can go from Scotland to Kentucky within the space of 20 miles. So how do you want to age it? You
know,
you can blend. You can do whatever.
It would insert – we'll also see, I think, probably stuff from, you know, places like South Africa, South America, Central America.
Yeah.
I mean, as the whiskey craze continues to build momentum –
I'm not surprised if we don't start seeing it from like West Africa.
Yeah,
you know?
It's true too.
Yeah, they grow a lot of grain there.
Yeah,
they've got a lot of millet. They've got a lot of corn. They've got all kinds.
It would be teff whiskey. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, why not, right?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this new day of whiskey drinking and whiskey production.
Yeah, it's exciting times for the whiskey business. That's
absolutely.
For sure.
The only problem is too many whiskeys, too little time.
Yeah.
But we'll continue working on that problem.
Yeah, we'll put our best men on it.
Cheers!
Cheers!
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.